Hey, this is Brad. We're off today, but please enjoy this encore presentation of the Bradcast.
You're going to love this. Just love it.
Pacifica Radio, this is The Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles. In Oregon, on 91.7 FM KYAQ Central Coast, 106.7 FM Queso Cottage Grove. In Pennsylvania, on 92.9 FM WLRI Lancaster. In Hawaii, on 88.5 FM KAKU, The Voice of Maui. In Ohio, on WGRN 94.1 FM Columbus. In Palenville, New York, on 102.9 FM WLPP. In Grand Rapids, Michigan, on WPRR Public Reality Radio. In New Orleans, on 102.3 WHIV. In Washington, D.C., on 105.5 FM. In Minneapolis, St. Paul, on AM 950 KTNF, The Progressive Voice of Minnesota. And coast to coast and around the globe, streaming on the internets on Progressive Voices Channel, Netroots Radio, Indie Media Weekly, FYI Nation, NicoleSandler.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, GDPR Revolution 99, Deprogrammed Radio, and Detour Talk. As usually hosted by Brad Friedman, but today you have me, Angie Coiro, and a very special guest. It is the holiday season, and our politics and economics still suck. The White House is still under the tyrannical reign of the toddler-in-chief. Our budget just got disemboweled, yay. Now it's a new tax law, no longer a bill. Healthcare is flatlining. The world continues to cook. On that last point, though, the terrifying reality of global warming, I want to bring you something more in keeping with the season today, more in keeping with light and hope and faith in the future. Because if anyone knows enough about climate change to just give up and sit down sobbing and never get up, that would be Al Gore. Our former vice president spends 28 hours a day, 10 days a week, sucking up all the available knowledge of just how dire our situation is. Then he goes around encouraging people to do good things to change that. Now, you've got to admit, that is pretty impressive and resilient, and maybe a shot in the arm for those of us who focus daily on how bad everything is. It has been more than 10 years since the original book and movie Inconvenient Truth came out, that landmark combination of science and cry from the heart and SOS to get involved. He's back, and it's a book-movie combo again, an inconvenient sequel, Truth to Power. Now, the movie follows Gore as he works around the world negotiating policy change and encouraging new activists. The book is an update on climate science, quite a beautiful piece of work, by the way, and a handbook for activists. I'm the host of In Deep with Angie Coiro, heard on some of these very same stations and streams, and I was really thrilled to interview Al Gore on stage for In Deep 2 weeks ago. Now, Brad and I thought this was something you would enjoy here, too, a bit of light as we approach the end of this relentlessly bleak year. Here's former Vice President Al Gore, the founder and chair of the Alliance for Climate Protection and the author of An Inconvenient Sequel, greeting a packed theater in San Mateo, California. I want to put a framework around tonight that I stole right out of the book. And it's a little more than halfway through the book. And you say, we ought to feel a sense of joy that we are alive at a moment when we can join with one another in a great cause, the stakes of which have never been higher. Mm. I wanted to acknowledge some of the things that are in the news, and these are challenges to joy. The Carnegie Institution for Science today reported in a new study that the Paris Accord goals are likely too optimistic. The most dire warming scenarios are probably the most accurate.
And it's not rare to get bad news like that. For every time we hear of a gain, we hear of something terrible. In this framework of ongoing hope and ongoing joy and the opportunity, how do you process it? You hear a story like that, what's going on here?
Well, it's a thoughtful question, and I see reports like the one you cited, and you're right, there are many of them. I see them in the context of a larger process of change that I think is gaining momentum. There was a famous economist in the last century, Rudy Dornbusch, who once wrote, "Things take longer to happen than you think they will, but then they happen much faster than you thought they ever could." And here in the region of Silicon Valley, we have learned to expect what they call exponential curves, with change seeming to take forever, and then all of a sudden they take off. Computer chips, genomic sequencing, cell phones, flat screen TVs. The good news in the world today is that renewable energy technology, principally solar, photovoltaics, and wind, are following a similar trajectory, a similar exponential curve. Mm-hmm. Batteries are now following the same path. Electric vehicles are spreading wildly. LEDs. The world, I believe, is in the early stages of a sustainability revolution that has the magnitude of the Industrial Revolution, but the speed of the digital revolution. And we've seen the decoupling of CO2 and other greenhouse gas emissions from economic progress. I've been at this for about 40 years, and from the very beginning, the hard problem has been that the maximum that's politically feasible has fallen way short of the minimum that would satisfy the laws of physics and really solve the crisis. So what do you do that? You have two options, basically. You can curl up in a fetal position and fall into despair. or you can work on expanding the limits of what is politically feasible. And we have seen a big increase in political feasibility. In Paris, 2 years ago next week, 197 nations, two of them held back, Syria and Iraq, but now they've signed as well. Every nation in the world signed this agreement to bring down to net zero global warming pollution by mid-century, or as soon thereafter as possible. And I know what you're thinking, Trump. he did announce that he wants to pull out of the agreement, but there are two things that you need to know about that. Number one, the agreement was pretty carefully written, and the first date upon which the U.S. could legally withdraw from the treaty happens to be one day after the next presidential election in 2020. So a new president could simply give 30 days notice, and the U.S. would be back in the agreement. Second thing is that thanks to your great governor, Jerry Brown, who I think is a real hero climate struggle, and Governor Jay Inslee from the state of Washington and Governor Andrew Cuomo from New York, and now 12 other states have all said we're still in the Paris Agreement. Hundreds of cities have said we're still in, hundreds of universities, thousands of business leaders, we're still in. And the projections now are that the U.S. will meet and exceed the commitments under the Paris Agreement, regardless of what Trump tweets or says or does. So that's the good news, and that is evidence that the limits of what's feasible have expanded. But this report you cited, one of many, does make the point that even if every country in the world fully meets the commitments signed up to in Paris, it still wouldn't be enough. But we're closer than we have been. And the agreement has another provision. This is a mandatory, but most of it's voluntary. This is mandatory, that every 5 years, every country has to reevaluate with transparent information whether or not they can make bolder commitments to have steeper reductions. And that process will start on the first period a year from this week in a meeting in Warsaw, Poland. Now, because the cost of renewables and the other things I mentioned continue to plummet, it is predictable that a majority of countries will, in fact, be able to expand their commitments. So it's a race. The problem's getting worse, faster than we feared, but the solutions are developing faster than we hoped, and they're gaining momentum. And when there are certain thresholds. There are thresholds in the environment, unfortunately. There are also thresholds in economics and politics. And when the cost of electricity from the sun and the wind goes well below the cost from burning fossil fuels without subsidies, then a kind of a dam breaks and you have a flood of investments. In fact, this is the seventh year in a row that global investments in renewable sources of electricity have exceeded investments in fossil fuel electricity, and the gap grows year by year.
Mm-hmm.
There are many other examples I could cite, but I'll just cite one more. Just since the Paris Agreement, India has done a U-turn. They're building an enormous quantity of new solar farms, 175 gigawatts, which is a huge amount. And they've just announced that within only 13 years, 100% of all their new cars and trucks will have to be electric vehicles. They're ahead of us on that by a good ways. That's a very hopeful sign.
A lot of very savvy political voices are talking about the void of world leadership, both environmentally and otherwise, that we're seeing from America. And the same voices are saying that China stands ready to lead in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
China is not the strongest when it comes to the environment. So what possibilities are we looking if, in fact, they start taking the lead?
Well, China is trying to fill the vacuum left by the U.S. somewhat withdrawing from its leadership position. President Xi Jinping of China has very consciously set out to make China the leading nation in the world. He's made speeches at Davos, at the World Economic Forum last January. It was a stunning event. Everybody who was there said, "What just happened?" It was as if you could translate his speech into saying, "You know, the U.S. used to be the leader. I'm going to do this now." And what he said in substance about trade, about the global environment, about structures of peace, etc., is a speech that an American president could have made. When he spoke last month at the conclusion of the Party Congress in China, the same thing. And if you look at their proposals, this One Belt, One Road proposal is many times larger than the Marshall Plan that we launched after World War II for a lot of countries. I was in Eastern Europe last week, and they have a huge initiative there. All the Eastern European and Central European countries are now beginning to look to China for assistance in building their highways and bridges and support for renewable energy and all kinds of things. Now, you said they're not the best on the environment. I'd qualify that. You're right in the sense that they're the biggest emitter by far, and even on a per capita basis, you know, they have 1.4 billion people, but on a per capita basis, they have more emissions than Europe does now. They're still burning that much coal. But their coal use peaked in 2014. They've been coming down. They build more than half of all the solar panels in the world, a similar fraction of all the windmills. They're introducing a cap and trade program. They're really enforcing environmental restrictions now. Now they have to because their air is so dirty from the co-pollutants that conventional air pollution. Life expectancy in northern China has gone down 5.5 years just in the last 30 years because of the air pollution alone. And that's a political issue for them. But they also recognize the climate crisis for what it is, and they genuinely want to provide leadership. The Paris Agreement, by the way, was really made possible in many ways by an agreement between former President Barack Obama and President Xi Jinping 1 year before the Paris Agreement, where the two countries agreed to work together. That's now in jeopardy because of Donald Trump, but China is determined to move forward anyway.
Mm-hmm. It's fascinating to watch in the movie, and we're going to talk about how everyone can become activist.
Yeah.
You operate at a higher plane than most of us can aspire to because you have a name, because you have access, entree. It was interesting to watch you at the various conferences throughout the movie, dealing in some pretty heavy-duty terms across the table from people insisting on staying with coal. One person in particular from India holding America's feet to the fire about where we are failing. And then later in the film, we see you negotiating to a point of agreement. You're doing the work on the phone and, hey, can we get this to happen here? Are there lessons that people who don't have your profile and don't work at that level, are there lessons to learn for us watching you do that?
Well, thank you. Yes, I think that everybody can make a difference. You know, I hold trainings all around the world for climate activists. I had one in Denver earlier this year. And a bunch of students from Colorado State came, and the president of Colorado State came and announced that they were going 100% renewable. And Colorado State is known as a very conservative institution, and they have a very conservative board. And I asked her, and why, I'm really happy about it, but how did this happen? She said, well, we got way more student signatures on a petition behind this than we have ever had for any cause that we've ever dealt with. And so they bent to the will of the student body. Cities can be persuaded. There's a conservative city in the heart of oil country in Texas that is in the movie. The mayor is a conservative Republican Trump supporter, but he happens to be a CPA. And he knows numbers really well, and he did the math and saw they could save money. And so the city went 100% renewable, and a lot of cities are now doing that. Some, I think more than 50 have now made that pledge in the U.S., including big cities like Pittsburgh and Atlanta. And that starts at the local level, and there's strength in numbers. And there's value in passion. That's essential to really care about this and not give up.
That reminds me of maybe my favorite moment in the sequel movie, and that is the footage of Senator Inhofe, who is probably the most anti-science, anti-reality person in the Congress.
Yeah.
And he was supposed to be questioning you at a hearing, but he was haranguing you. And finally, you were allowed to answer the question. And you took him on. You never see anybody pause at these hearings to stop and think. It's almost illegal. And you, like, really stopped and thought. Mm. And then you spoke to him very personally.
Yeah.
And you said, I really wish we could be alone, away from the cameras. I'd really like to talk to you.
Yeah.
Whether you convinced him at all, indications are you did not. It speaks to how at least we have to make that effort. And the passion does come out.
Yeah, and that can work. You know, one of the problems with the climate issue today is that there's a false equivalent to say that both parties have done it. I'm a Democrat, so you have to take with a grain of salt what I say about the direction of the Republican Party today. But I think the evidence bears out what I'm about to say, that they have really made it a kind of a litmus test for Republicans to be against doing anything to acknowledge that there is a climate crisis, much less solve it. That's beginning to break down, though. And conversations, personal in nature, sincere, can make a difference. I'll tell you a story. I was last year, I was at the at an airport getting out of the car to go into the terminal building, and a man came up, and he introduced himself. His name was Jerry Taylor. And his story is quite remarkable. He told me there on the curb that for 20 years he was at an organization called the Cato Institute, which is one of the conservative think tanks in Washington, and he was the guy in charge of disseminating climate denial. 20 years. And he said, I want you to know you've convinced me. I've changed my mind. I want to know how I can help. And he told me that he personally knows of at least 10 Republican members of the U.S. Senate who are actively trying to figure out how to come back from the end of the long limb they're on and change their position publicly on climate.
It's the Bradcast. I'm Angie Cuero. And today, coming up, more of Gore on the Bradcast.
Hey, this is Brad. You're listening to an encore presentation of the Bradcast. We'll be back soon.
In the year 2525.
You are listening to the Bradcast. I'm Angie Cuero, sitting in for Brad and Desi today, bringing you a special holiday listen to one of the real bright lights in the fight for what matters, former Vice President Al Gore. Here is more of our conversation.
Something in the movie kind of surprised me is that you went into a recounting of the Bush-Gore decision. I have to acknowledge all the audience questions that say, you ought to be president. I just have to acknowledge that.
Oh. I would have come here just to hear that.
But the film is about climate change and it's about activism, and I wonder why you put that in there.
Well, I didn't put it in there. The directors are from San Francisco, Bonnie Cohen and John Schenck, great filmmakers. And the best evidence that I did not have control over the content is that in my mind, I'm younger and thinner with darker hair. And some of those scenes never would have made it. But if you, I haven't asked them why they put that in. I think that there was a short stretch in the movie where they wanted to communicate how long I've been doing this. And that's kind of a lump in that story that they wanted to put in. But you'd have to ask them.
Well, you've tried to do this within the system, and now you've been working
for years
outside the system. So where do you feel you've been more effective, inside or outside?
Well, I really enjoyed being in the Congress and Senate, Vice President. And by the way, I'm under no illusion that there's any position with as much ability to influence the future for good as that of President of the United States. But since that wasn't to be, I'm really grateful to have found other ways to push for positive change. Mm-hmm. And I'm happy that I've been able to do some things outside the system, and I'm continuing to do it. I just finished Tuesday night. I came here from New York City. Every year, in addition to these training programs and our other activities, I do an annual 24-hour global telecast called 24 Hours of Reality. The NGO I lead is called the Climate Reality Project. And we start in the Eastern time zone and go west, and we hit the prime times in every single time zone all the way around the world and then come back to New York. We were broadcast into a half a billion homes this year, and we had 32 million online viewers. We trended number one on Facebook Live and YouTube several times during the 24 hours. I get a lot of good feedback from that, from people who say, I saw this, I changed my mind, I want to do what I can. I was talking with an engineer from Stanford earlier who said that as a result of the first movie, she really changed her life. That makes me feel great. And there are lots of people who have made a decision to be a part of solving this crisis. This is the most serious challenge humanity has ever faced. I mean, this is for real. I mean, we're using the sky as an open sewer. We're putting 110 million tons every day of man-made heat-trapping pollution. The cumulative amount now traps as much heat energy every day as would be released by 400,000 Hiroshima-class atomic bombs exploding every day. And it's a big planet, but that's a lot of heat energy, and it's really messing up the climate balance that has supported the flourishing of human civilization. And we're putting things at risk now that we simply should not put at risk. We're in danger of losing half of all the living species on the planet in this century. This is equivalent to the fifth great extinction when the asteroid hit near Yucatan, wiped out the dinosaurs 66 million years ago. This time it's not an asteroid, it's us colliding with the Earth's ecological system. And if we don't come to grips with it pretty quickly, then the consequences are just unimaginable. The good news is that we are acting now. We're gaining momentum, but it is still a race. We are not yet winning fast enough. We can. And here's a statistic that's hard to believe, but the math of all this heat-trapping pollution that we're putting up there, the math is above my pay grade. I do know this, that some of it that we put up there today will still be there 1,000 years from now, and some fraction 10,000 years from now. But if we could magically stop putting it up there tomorrow, which we can't, but if we could, how long would it take for half of it to fall out? The answer is 20 years. And the black carbon, the soot, it would fall out in 2 weeks.
Wow.
So if we really made up our minds to do this, it is easily within our ability to do it. The problem is we still rely on fossil fuels for 80% of all the energy used by the global economy. And so weaning ourselves off that quickly is extremely difficult, particularly when you have the oil and gas companies and the coal companies and the coal-burning utilities fighting every step of the way against change and using their lobbying and their political contributions and their centuries-old networks of influence, not only in this country but in other countries. In order to solve the climate crisis, we've got to address the democracy crisis, because our democracy has been hacked long before the Russians hacked it by lobbyists and big money special interest contributors. And we've really got to address that. We can, again, and I think the internet-based media, if we can solve the Russian bot problem and the fake news and echo chambers and all that, and then I think it gives us a chance to really have some effective grassroots activism. Every reform movement in the United States today lives and breathes on the internet, and it's growing, and people are finding it easier to get involved and to make a difference.
You don't put yourself out there as a psychologist, so I'm asking you to go kind of out on a limb here. I've always wondered, with the people who keep working hard to put pollutants into the air and to make money off of that, don't they have kids?
Yeah.
I'm serious. I mean, what's going on there that they think that they'll escape what's happening? I don't understand that.
Well, there was a famous investigative journalist in the U.S. Over 100 years ago, Upton Sinclair, and he said it's hard to get a man to understand something if his salary depends upon him not understanding it. And I think that's a big part of this. George Orwell once said, people are capable of believing fervently in a lie indefinitely until it collides with reality, often on a battlefield. And here the collision with reality is in the destruction of the ecological system. But we're all capable of fooling ourselves. You know, a lot of times what the psychologists do tell us is that we'll make a decision based on emotions or some other factor and then rationalize it and put our minds to work convincing ourselves, you know, that the decision we've made irrationally is correct. And I think the polluters who have kids find it easy to ignore the impact on their children if they have blinded themselves to even feeling what that's all about.
There's a wonderful corollary between the book and the movie in that both of them present some pretty dire stuff interspersed with just some amazing beauty and a great deal of positivity. One of our audience members wants to know, what kind of synergy you were looking for with the documentary coming out and the book coming out at the same time. What were you looking for then to be more than the sum of their parts?
Well, that's a great question. 11 years ago, I was pleasantly surprised at how the movie An Inconvenient Truth and the book of the same title worked together, and people would see the book in the bookstore and then they would get a ticket to the movie. They'd go to the movie and then they'd buy the book. And the fancy term for that is synergy. It's kind of an overused buzzword now, but it's a real thing. And all the profits, by the way, that I would otherwise get from both the movie and the book go 100% to the Climate Reality Project to finance more trainings and more activism at the around the world.
One of the shifts that you make from the dire to the hopeful, and this again is both in the movie and the book, we do see some really devastating things. You particularly spend some time on a super typhoon in the Philippines.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's difficult to watch both in retrospect and in the person of someone who appears to want at one of the trainings.
Yeah.
A young adult, he is still in tears and still afraid of what happened to him. But the cool part about that is he's there to make a difference.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Post-traumatic stress, it's a real thing. And but we don't have to go halfway around the world to the Philippines. We can just look at California today.
Oh, yeah.
And here in Northern California, not long ago, you had the big fires in Napa and Sonoma, and some people had to evacuate their kids from the Bay Area because of the smoke and air pollution. Right now, in Ventura and Bel Air, somebody said it looked like a volcano went off. Now it's in San Diego County, and it's December. And when I did this global broadcast, we began at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on Monday. That was about the exact time when the Ventura fire started. And exactly 24 hours later, when I closed the show, I made note of that and said, and now 60,000 acres have burned, 30,000 people have been evacuated, and they say it's impossible to control it. The Santa Ana winds are now at a hurricane category 1 force there. And before these fires this week, it was already by far the worst fire season in the history of California. And not too many months ago, we had Hurricane Harvey hit Houston, Texas, and it dropped 5 feet of rain. 5 feet of rain? Texas and Louisiana, that storm dropped on the U.S. as much water equal to 509 days of the full flow of Niagara Falls in 5 days. This is bizarre, bizarre. And then right after that, Hurricane Irma hit and destroyed part of the Florida Keys and hit Grace, Puerto Rico, did a lot of damage. Then Hurricane Maria flattened Puerto Rico, the Caribbean islands. We have had in the last 7 years in the U.S. 14 once-in-a-thousand-year events. Now, I'm not an expert on statistics, but I'm given to believe that you're not supposed to have a once-in-a-thousand-year event every 6 months. It just, it doesn't work. Mm-hmm. And the same week Houston was hit, almost 10 times that number of people were killed in South Asia. Bangladesh was, 1/3 of Bangladesh was underwater. An extra 50 centimeters hit eastern India. 100,000 homes destroyed in Nigeria, all that same week. This is a global, every night on the evening news is like a nature hike through the book of Revelation now. Seriously. And the newscasters have not been covering the issue. They have not been connecting the dots. There are a few honorable exceptions.
In fact, can I ask you about that? Because I know that you've mentioned in a number of venues that it makes you really angry with the news, that they'll cover what's happening right now. Here's where the crisis is now. But they don't connect it to global warming.
Right, right.
In their defense, I'm playing devil's advocate here, in their defense, you can question any weather scientist, climatologist, who will tell you, We can't flawlessly connect a given event to global warming. Now, obviously, the big missing thing in that picture is, sure, but then we have 5 to 10 events in the same month.
You know? Well, it's actually, I would challenge you on your statement. I know where your statement comes from, and I've made it myself in years past. But the leading scientists now describe the relationship between these extreme weather event, climate-related extreme weather events and the climate crisis. They describe it differently now. There's a difference between linear cause and effect, one cause, one effect, and what's called systemic cause and effect. If you have a complex system that's causing a lot of consequences, and then you radically disrupt that complex system, then all the effects are different. And the leading scientists are now saying every storm is different now because of the climate crisis. We have 5% more humidity in the atmosphere today than 30 years ago. That's incredible. You know, more than 90% of this extra heat energy is going into the oceans, and it's vastly increasing the water vapor coming off the oceans into the sky, and the warmer air holds more water vapor. For each 1 degree increase, there's a 7% increase in the holding capacity of water by the air. And when it comes over the land, then we get these rain bombs, they're calling them. So every storm is different now. For example, Hurricane Harvey, it crossed areas of the Gulf of Mexico up to 7 degrees warmer than normal. And in the past, as hurricanes approached the land, they would churn cold water up from deeper in the ocean. And when they churn up cold water, then it starts to calm down a little bit just before it hits land. But so much heat has gone into the oceans now that it went all the way down 200 meters to the bottom of the Gulf of Mexico. So there was no cold water in the stack. So it kept getting stronger as it approached the land. And now we have seen the accelerated warming in the Arctic, melting the ice. I had a conversation about this earlier. The jet stream that comes across North America is defined by the difference in the cold temperature of the Arctic and the warmer temperatures farther south. Because the ice is melting in the Arctic, it's heating up twice as fast. So that temperature differential is changing. This is a little complicated, but bear with me here, because this is what is responsible for the weather pattern that California has today, mm-hmm. And the reason why it's colder than normal in the east today. The jet stream normally comes in a wavy line across, but now it's getting disorganized, and you get this pattern where it goes way up and then way down, and sometimes it just falls apart. Hurricane Harvey was held in place for 5 days. It wasn't moved up and out to the east as normally happens because it was locked in place. And what we have locked in place now is this extremely dry air, hot, dry air in the west. And the Arctic is spilling, the cold air from the Arctic is spilling down in the east, the so-called polar vortex. And it's because we're seeing the disorganization of the climate pattern.
Brad and Desi are out today. I'm Angie Cuero sitting in, and we're going to pick it up from there with former Vice President Al Gore when we come back on the Bradcast.
So this hey, this is Brad. You're listening to an encore presentation of the Bradcast.
What have you done? Another year over.
Here on the Bradcast today, a brightly colored gift for those of you who suffer the endless onslaught of bad news from the White House, including the tax bill, which has now gone from nightmare to waking nightmare with Trump's proud and idiotic signature. So let's go back to the guarded, deeply informed, optimistic activism of Al Gore. Now that climate scientists agree that all weather patterns are affected by global warming, that every storm is different now, why, he wants to know, isn't that regularly in news and weather reporting, or for that matter, in political discourse.
We have just come through the third four-year presidential cycle in a row where not one single question about climate was asked in any of the debates to any of the candidates. That's ridiculous. It's ridiculous. They did a study of all the news coverage on the four main broadcast networks in calendar year 2016. The sum total of all the networks for 365 days that they devoted to climate was 45 minutes. 45 minutes, four networks, 365 days. That is pathetic. Mm-hmm. Now, why is it happening? Why is it happening? I think that the line between news and entertainment has eroded. The days of Walter Cronkite are pretty much over. And we have great journalists. They're probably the best, most educated, dedicated ever. But they're part of organizations now owned by conglomerates where it's not a public service, it's another opportunity to add more money to the bottom line. And that means paying attention to the ratings. And if a subject is covered that causes some fraction of your audience to get angry and change the channel, that hurts financially. It's like a dysfunctional family with an alcoholic father who flies into a rage if the word alcohol is mentioned, so the rest of the family kind of tiptoes around the elephant in the middle of the dining room table. And so for a variety of reasons, I'm convinced that's one of them, they're just reluctant to make that fraction of the audience furious at them. And so they, let's don't get into climate. Let's don't talk about climate. And so they don't, but it's a disservice to our democracy.
Well, that's a good entry point for activism. One of the things about activism, and the book is full of different ways that you can all channel your passions, pick your area, and how to
it's
move forward.
It's a handbook for activism.
Yeah. One of the things about activism is you have to learn to triage. You have to learn to say, this is a waste of effort, so I'm going to go this way. When you're talking about the monolith of media that, you know, increasingly held in fewer and fewer hands, and a lot of those have vested interests in not covering the news,
right.
As an activist, do you work to change that with them, or do you say, media is no longer with us, we're going to go this way?
Well, I think that it depends on where you live and what your skills are and what you want to, what kind of activism you're drawn toward. A lot of people are now having more luck at the local level and at the state level. I think maybe the influence of the large carbon polluters is maximized at the national level where they finance campaigns and the lobbyists are there all the time. And they don't have that as much influence at the municipal level and in a lot of states. So that's why you have this odd thing where the Congress is scared to even, I mean, the majority in the Congress is scared to use the word climate, but a lot of states are just going full speed toward renewables and reduction of greenhouse gases. And so I think a lot of activists are having better luck in those venues now.
You say that you're a recovering politician who never wants to relapse.
Well, I've said that the longer I go without a relapse, the less likely one becomes.
Given that, I mean, that speaks a little bit to the world of politicians, and as you say yourself, Congress doesn't seem to get a whole lot done, some out of fear, some out of, you know, entrenched power. Again, with the triaging, how do we decide within our own communities whether it's worth talking to our specific politician? Does it matter if they are, for example, owned and run by a corporation that is vested in polluting?
Yeah.
Is it worth talking to them? Or again, you do an end run?
Well, I you know, in the years I was in the Congress, I found that there was a very effective formula people could use. First of all, there's strength in numbers. And if you can get a whole posse of people who agree with you and are willing to back you up, and you go to a candidate or an elected official anticipating running for re-election and deliver a two-part message. Number one, we want you to do the right thing on climate. And if you do, we're going to really help you get re-elected. If you don't, I promise you, we will do everything within our power to make sure you are defeated in the next election. I promise you. That kind of works a lot of times. And if it's a hard case, like the hypothetical, then you need more people. But there's a threshold you can cross where you can bring about change. You take a congressman from a really conservative Republican from California, Daryl Issa from far south. He just announced that he's changing his position on climate. Why? Because enough people in his congressional district read him the Riot Act. And he's got an opponent who's really good on the issue. I mean, don't give up. I mentioned this training in Denver. Since then, I've had one in Seattle. I've got one coming up in Mexico City. But at Denver, this 11-year-old girl showed up. And I asked the staff, I said, you know, don't we need an age limit? I mean, what is... And all of a sudden, I sounded like the guy with the carnival ride that said, you have to be this tall to... She signed up, and I noticed for 3 days she's taking notes just all the time. 2 weeks later, I click on this video that's going viral. I didn't recognize her at first, but then I did. She showed up at the town hall meeting of her Republican congressman and got the microphone, and she was just giving him hell on climate. And I thought, you go, girl. So I invited her to be a part of this global telecast at the beginning of the week, and she was great, really great. So, you know, when enough people make up their mind that they're going to make a difference, you know, they shouldn't be surprised if they do make a difference.
If we want to bring up young activists, we want them to be aware, but we also want to be age appropriate. You don't want to scare the hell out of a little kid. How do you start talking to the very young about climate?
Well, that's one of the reasons why I, you know, wondered whether we should train her. But, you know, these kids get it. I mean, I think young people are farther ahead of the game than we give them credit for. They kind of know what's going on. But I guess for kids, for people of any age, I'm reluctant to, you know, scare people. At the same time, you have to be honest about the reality of what we're facing. You mentioned earlier that there was a leavening of these messages of urgency with images of beauty and messages of hope. That's just common sense, you know. When I train people to give the slideshow and their own version of the slideshow, I say you have a time budget, you have a complexity budget, and you have a hope budget. And you can't bust any of those budgets. And you have to be honest with people about the danger we're facing. It's wrong not to. But you have to leaven it with legitimate hope, and there is legitimate hope. And maybe I get the balance wrong sometimes, but I try and I learn.
One of our audience members wants to know, we'll make this a two-part question, what can be done to stop the executive order to redraw the Bears Ears National Monument? Hmm. And the second part of that, can you please make that connection for us between the privatization of land and climate change? Because there is a connection.
Yeah. Well, it's Bears Ears and the Grand Staircase Escalante, both of them in Utah. There will be challenges in court. Patagonia, God bless them, is one of the ones launching a lawsuit. I love that company. They're just great. So that's one thing. But since it was created by executive order, the Grand Staircase Escalante was one of my initiatives when I was vice president. Bears Ears came under the Obama administration. They're both kind of there. So what's the connection to climate? Okay. One of the most exciting areas in the world for studying dinosaurs is in this protected area. But instead of going for the fossils, they want to go for the fossil fuels and tear up the landscape to try to drill for more oil and more gas. So, and they want to go to the Arctic and drill for oil and gas in the Arctic, which is utterly insane. Here's one of the many reasons why. We have about $28 trillion. I know that's an impossible number for any of us to wrap our minds around, but it's a lot of oil and gas, mainly, and some coal, that is marked down as highly valuable on the books of multinational oil companies and sovereigns like Saudi Arabia and Venezuela. And more than two-thirds of it can never be burned. If the world's going to have a chance to keep the temperature increase at a survivable level. And the International Energy Agency, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, there's a consensus on this. So if we already have three times as much found, discovered, proven, ready to produce, we have three times as much as can be burned, why should we go out to try to find more? Well, the company's stock will go up if they can add to their reserves. But at some point, reality takes hold. You remember the subprime mortgage crisis. There were 7.5 million mortgages given to people who couldn't make a down payment, much less make their monthly payments. Now, when I was a young man, I signed my first home mortgage in Carthage, Tennessee, population 2000, and I sat across the desk from a man named Walter Glenn Birdwell Jr. I'll never forget it. And he asked me, I was in my 20s, early 20s, he asked me a long series of questions designed to build his confidence that I could make the monthly payments. Well, none of these mortgages would have survived Walter Glenn Birdwell Jr. But the banks convinced themselves that if they could just lump together millions of them and attach them to some phony quasi-insurance document that was worthless too, and then sell the package into the global markets, that somehow the risk would magically disappear. And then this guy down near Stanford, who has the patience of Job, just started peeling the layers of the onion back, and he went, oh, these are worthless. And he made a ton of money, and word began to get out, and then other investors said, you mean they're worthless? Yeah. And so their value just collapsed almost overnight. And that's what caused the credit crisis, a run on the banks, and that's what caused the Great Recession. Mm-hmm. So we have subprime carbon assets now, $22 trillion worth. And they will at some point soon be recognized as having essentially no value because they cannot be put to their intended use and be burned. So when will that happen? I don't know. But I know that last week, one of the largest sovereign wealth funds on the planet, the Norwegian Sovereign Wealth Fund, which got its money from producing oil and gas in the North Sea, surprised the world by announcing, we are getting completely out of all oil and gas stocks. Completely out of them, okay? And the stocks of the market capitalization of the coal industry worldwide has collapsed 90% in the last decade. The shift to electric cars, almost every automobile manufacturer in the world is now shifting to electric vehicles. A lot of countries, not just India, have announced a phase out of the internal combustion engine. So oil companies, their stocks are gonna, it's a fool's errand to predict the market, and I don't want anybody to take my advice on this, but I'm just saying that it's only a matter of time. So why do you want to dig up these dinosaur fields and completely ruin this beautiful landscape in Utah and risk utter environmental catastrophe in the Arctic Ocean to drill and produce stuff that we already have way too much of that can't be burned in the first place? It is insane.
Since you mentioned the subprime mortgage, there's a book by David Dayan, and it does cover how the subprime mortgage came about, but it was about how people got together to fight the banks. And then there's, you know, mentioned the Norwegian company, there's George Lakey's Viking Economics, and that is very optimistic about
fighting Keystone, about fighting things on many fronts. He's like 70, 80 years old, and he's still getting arrested because he thinks it's worth it. What other materials do you think are out there that are parallel to the movie and the book that not only offer an assessment of what's really happening, but also offer hope?
Well, you're better read than I am. I'm interested that you say this guy keeps getting arrested as a way of praising him. I feel the same thing. I mean, it's a sign of where we are that I tell people, my oldest daughter was arrested. I'm so proud of her. It's so she laid down in a trench that they were digging for one of these new gas pipeline networks. And I'm so proud of you, honey. You got arrested. But what other resources? Well, there's a lot of stuff online. The Indivisible organization, I think, is a great example of a new wave of activists. That's a great resource. And it's important to use the internet, but then it's important to follow up by actually meeting real people in person live, because otherwise it's just clicking on boxes. But using the internet to organize and then organizing for real in person and getting politically active. Use your voice. Win the conversation on climate. Use your vote. Use your choices in life. When people demand the climate-friendly alternatives, that not only helps you be a part of the solution, it sends a powerful signal to business, to designers, to engineers, that there's a growing market for the climate-friendly alternatives. And that drives this change in markets that we're seeing now. Go to the Climate Reality Project, climatereality.org. Come to a 3-day training, Mexico City, but next summer we're going to have one in California at the end of the summer. We'll be in Berlin. And, knowledge is power. There's strength in numbers. Remember the passion. Do something. Get involved. I mean, fight like your world depends on it, because it does, actually.
I usually thank people at the end for the conversation. I want to thank you for everything. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you, Angie.
Those are highlights of my interview with former Vice President Al Gore, author of the book and subject of the documentary, both entitled An Inconvenient Sequel, Truth to Power. Recorded for In Deep and shared with you because Brad and I both figured you could use a shot in the arm today. Special thanks to the Kepler's Literary Foundation, who produced the evening event, and to the wonderful people on Al Gore's team who made it possible. Good people are still on the job. That's it for the broadcast. I'm Angie Cuero, sitting in for Brad and Desi. Chin up. And as always, good luck, world.